But now on Radio 4, Steve Punt continues his assignment as Radio 4's very own gumshoe. And this week, the mystery is airborne, as our dogged detective embarks on a mission to explain some strange goings-on in the Second World War. It's another case for Punt PI.
This is Punt's private eye. I'm not here right now. Please leave a message.
Tracy, listen very carefully. There's just been a whole cache of secret files released by the Ministry of Defense, some of them concerning UFO sightings during the last war. Now, I've received separate intel that the Nazis developed some sort of flying saucer technology. See if you can find a link. But I need hard evidence on this, Punt. Hearsay simply won't do. It won't do at all.
If you want to be taken seriously as a private detective, then a mission to track down Nazi flying saucers is quite low on the assignment list. I wondered briefly if Tracy had been trying to call Indiana Jones and got the wrong number. Did the Fuhrer really have airborne crockery buzzing around over Europe? It seemed far-fetched. I nearly told Tracy he'd got the wrong guy and suggested he try Channel 5. But then I remembered something. Something that I'd seen in the paper not long before.
Okay, National Archives.
Those newly released files he'd mentioned were real enough.
Right. Air Ministry.
Deep in the National Archives are reports that seem to describe close encounters of the Third Reich.
There's loads of these.
As I started leafing through previously classified files from Britain and America, my mind started whirring faster than an anti-gravity disc.
Lancaster bomber. Returning from raid over Germany, reported four orange balls of light.
As I read through the reports, it soon became clear what Tracy was getting at when he talked about UFO sightings during the war.
3rd of April 1945, B-29 formation, 7-1, ball of fire at 10,000 feet, red light at the 6 o'clock position, which had a phosphorescent glow.
These sightings were not reported by strange blokes in anoraks or farmers from rural Arkansas. They were reported in their dozens, official records showed, by Allied bomber crews in the night skies over wartime Europe and Japan.
Wall of fire followed aircraft despite evasive maneuvers, unable to shake the lights off, which eventually seemed to burn themselves out.
The worry was that they might indicate some new German super weapon, and they were kept top secret. Supposedly, even Churchill himself got involved.
A letter makes claims about a meeting between PM Winston Churchill and US President Eisenhower when a wartime UFO incident reported by RAF bomber crew was discussed.
I needed an expert view, and no one knows these files better than David Clark, consultant to the National Archives on the release of UFO files. He told me that they were taken so seriously at the time that they got a comedian to look into them.
The late Michael Benteen, who was an intelligence officer for the RAF during the war, he remembered on two occasions debriefing Polish bomber crews who'd been involved in raids on the Peenemünde base in the Baltic, and they'd seen strange, bizarre lights that had appeared from nowhere and were very, very concerned about it. And he debriefed them, and he was saying, you know, well, what did they do? Did they attack you? They said, no, they didn't do us any harm at all. And Michael Benteen said his response was, well, he wasn't a very good secret weapon, then he wasn't very effective.
That far from goonish logic is hard to argue with. Was this all just potty time? To investigate these X-Files, I decided to play Mulder rather than Scully. Apart from anything else, the hair would take too long, and look for a rational explanation. If I could find one.
Hi. Oh, hi. I'm trying to get...
It was obvious the sightings couldn't be explained by regular German aircraft, but I wondered whether there was any new technology flying around that might have explained these phenomena.
Have any kind of...
Hi, yes. Hello.
0049... Thanks a lot. Thank you, you've been really helpful.
And after a little more legwork, performed mainly by fingers, I made contact with Andrew Nahum, a curator at the Science Museum, who told me about an item in their collection that rather intrigued me.
This is the Messerschmitt 163B Comet, the world's only operational rocket fighter. And it was probably the most dangerous operational aircraft that's ever been put into service.
Surely this would have spooked any propeller-driven Allied pilot.
How fast did it go?
About 580 miles an hour, at between 10,000 and 25,000 feet. So it was maybe 200 miles an hour, maybe more, faster than the bombers it was attacking.
This was interesting. Could this 580-mile-an-hour silver cylinder explain the mysterious sightings?
What would have come out of that rocket? Would it be a flame, or what would it have looked like?
Funnily enough, it came in two versions. There was the cold version and the hot version. The cold version just used hydrogen peroxide and sodium permanganate, so you got a steam jet, if you like. The hot version used hydrazine, and when they went together, mostly what you saw would have been a column of blacky white smoke.
Right.
It didn't rise on a pillar of fire like later rockets did.
Right,
So the Nazis were clearly up to some pretty advanced stuff, but the rocket engines didn't look like balls of fire, and the plane couldn't follow or track its target as described in the reports. The rocket theory disappeared in a trail of blacky white smoke.
Hello. Oh, good afternoon.
020.
Leaving me to find other examples of advanced Nazi aircraft, which might be closer to the descriptions in the files.
I think most of the projects you want to talk about would be in this book.
I met up with Robert Forsyth and Eddie Neelinger, who've written a series of books on secret German aviation projects.
This is the nearest thing to the flying saucer. This was an idea in 1941, which is basically a flying saucer. The whole thing would have rotated, and that's what would have taken it up into the air, and the forward thrust would have been performed by these two.
Right.
And the pilot would sit in this little capsule underneath. You've got to understand, this was purely an idea that somebody had put together, but when you see it, it doesn't look bad. It looks like quite something from the future, like a UFO, for instance.
Eddie was clear that this particular project had never taken wing, but Robert was keeping an open mind as to whether there might have been other projects that did.
I think the truth is that there is much that we still don't know. Records still continue to emerge. There are still documents coming out. I think much remains an enigma, but there is no doubt that they probably looked under every little aeronautical stone, and whether they pushed beyond that to the realms of anti-gravity, I'm not sure will ever be known, but it can't be ruled out.
This put the investigation back on the radar. Could it be that the Nazis were not just trying to develop circular aircraft, but also an entirely new form of anti-gravity propulsion? Intriguing as it was a mountain of unverified claims and a molehill of evidence. But then...
Punt, Tracy again. You're not really getting very far, are you? Listen, I've got something for you. Booked you on a flight to Poland. You're off to Wroclaw, near the Czech border. Contact name, Igor. He'll meet you at the other end. It's time to start getting some results on this, punt.
What could this mean? It was all a bit sudden. I threw some clothes into a suitcase and headed straight for the airport, wondering briefly whether there was a baggage limit on a flying saucer.
Right, gate three. Now, I need gate three, or I might end up in Gdansk.
The plane was leaving imminently. I was heading into the unknown. From Luton. As I crossed the tarmac to board the plane, I couldn't stop asking myself, why was Tracy sending me to Poland? Who was Igor, and what was he going to show me? On board the plane, I examined a vital document, and I came to a firm conclusion.
Can I have a tea and a cheese sandwich, please?
But over the tea and a cheese sandwich, I could make no further sense of the assignment. That would have to wait. I landed in Wroclaw, Poland, or as it was known until the end of the war, Breslau, Germany. Making my way through passport control, I looked for my contact, Igor.
Part-time Igor at the moment.
A good 15 minutes passed before a man came up to me and told me to follow him.
Excuse me. Okay.
He motioned to me to get into his car, which seemed to be experiencing problems with its own propulsion system. The heavens opened as we headed out of town to the south towards the Czech border, a drive which Igor told me would take around 2 hours. He also revealed that he was a military journalist and researcher, but beyond that, he was playing his cards close to his chest. Turning left, away from the main road, we began winding into the foothills of the Owl Mountains of Lower Silesia.
We are approaching our destination.
A strategically important area of what was then Germany.
Such a road has a tricky point.
Eventually we arrived at what looked like a cave set into a hillside, but the cave was man-made.
We are just about to enter the Riese complex. It was supposed to be one of the largest underground factories in the Third Reich. So we're just entering it.
The Riese means giant in German, and we followed a network of tunnels which had been built by slave labor.
It was supposed to be a big complex dedicated to the research and production of strategic weapons, including some crafts that were supposed to be launched into space.
The complex we were standing in was large, with chambers high enough to house a V-2 rocket, but it was never completed. However, Igor told me this wasn't the full story.
I have managed to uncover a German document signed by the SS General Kammler, which says that all these facilities were part of something much larger, which was codenamed S3. It covered an area of, I would say, 20 kilometers. Probably it was the most important and largest project of the SS during the entire war.
In other words, these tunnels and bunkers might not have been completed, but they were a key to somewhere else, which had been.
We just have to find a place where clear traces of extensive work are visible. And that's what I'm about to show you.
Further up into the mountains we went. There were few buildings, poor people.
We're now climbed up so high.
In the mountain, in the clouds.
In the clouds, it's got very misty.
20 minutes later, we headed down into a narrow valley.
What I would like to show you is the extensive scale of this infrastructure here, which is a clear indication that it was something serious carried out here, and that it was a facility that was finished.
Here in this isolated spot, Igor told me he believed that there was something very intriguing down below.
One of the most striking and unusual features is that there is a plenty of ventilation shafts here, which obviously clearly indicate that there is some extensive underground space.
All right, okay, so there's two concrete shafts there, another two about 10 meters away.
And the most unusual, in fact, feature is that the ventilation shafts are protected by bunkers.
So somewhere beneath our feet is some very, very important facility. There was something going on here.
Yes, and according to all the signs, it was very much secret.
Is it still possible to go down into the complex that's below here?
Nobody really tried. Attempts to access the main elevator shafts have failed.
A huge former coal mine lay underground, but on the surface were signs of a former military presence. Abandoned bunkers, sentry posts, defensive trenches sliced into the earth, and one less identifiable artifact.
That's one thing that I would like to show you.
We suddenly came upon something distinctly odd.
Enormous concrete structure.
Dubbed the henge or fly trap, it was a ring of concrete pillars, each about a metre thick, 10 meters high, and joined together at the top.
It's a strange thing, but what do you think it was used for?
It's a mysterious structure. It very much resembles a test rig. circular test rig for some objects taking off and landing vertically or something like that, such as a test rig used for helicopters, only that the other one for helicopters is smaller. It's not my vivid imagination, but it just looks like one.
So what sort of craft would that be, taking off vertically?
I don't know. I don't really know. It's one of the very many elements in this in this puzzle, and just one of many.
Igor then disappeared off for a few minutes, leaving me alone in the presence of this concrete enigma.
Now, Igor mentioned craft taking off and landing vertically in a rig like this. I really do wonder what sort of craft he means, and whether he really just means helicopters.
It was all a little spooky. And I was a little spooked. It was circular, it was mysterious, and it was heavily fortified. Was the truth out here?
Okay, we may go.
The truth was, Igor needed some dinner. So at 4 p.m, we headed for a local restaurant. The curtains were drawn, the walls were stone, and there was a chandelier made of deer skulls. But the food hit the spot. Assuming you weren't looking for a vegetarian option. We then headed back to the guest house where Igor had booked us in for the night. Here, he revealed what he believed had gone on in the converted mine below the isolated valley that we'd visited. It centred on a strange device called the bell.
It was supposed to be some kind of object resembling a bell. 3 meters high and 1.5 meters diameter, and inside of it were two cylinders, one above the other, containing some amount of mercury, and during an experiment they were rotated with very high speeds in opposite directions.
According to Igor, the Bell experiment was carried out in the huge S3 underground complex running on energy supplied by a nearby power station. The question was, what was it all for?
On the basis of my research, I adopted a hypothesis that it might have been used to explore gravity.
Igor's theory was that the Germans had been working on something that departed radically from Einstein's thinking on gravity. But how were they intending to employ this research? Igor then showed me some papers.
That's a document about a wave of sightings of strange flying crafts in Scandinavia shortly after the war.
More objects in the sky, this time over Sweden and Norway, and again from a bona fide military source.
And is this an American?
It's an American intelligence document, top secret then.
Yes, it says speeds were estimated at 2,800 kilometres an hour.
And they were flying mostly at very low altitudes, horizontally.
Yes, and it says they also followed a complex itinerary implicating changes of direction.
Sudden changes in direction of flight. Sudden changes.
Sudden changes of direction. So does that suggest any link between what went on around this area and what seems to have been going on just over a year later?
It's one of many confirmations that the Germans have developed some exotic technology. It's not a guess here. And for some reason, it was captured but was not continued by the Soviets.
So the Henge, the theory goes, could have been some kind of test rig for an aircraft employing anti-gravity propulsion, developed using the Bell device. Igor's knowledge of the Bell, though, hinges on the testimony of an SS Captain Sporenberg, who was supposedly responsible for getting the Bell out of the country at the end of the war. Igor said that a former intelligence officer had contacted him and shown him Sporenberg's testimony. I pressed him on this.
And you've seen documents, first-hand documents, that relate to this project.
Excuse me. I would prefer not to say what I have seen.
Okay.
Igor was maintaining radio silence, and it was getting late. The sun set on the Owl Mountains, and I went to bed pondering the gravity of anti-gravity. Did the bell ever exist? If so, what was it? And what was it for? Next morning, it was time to head home. If Igor could start the car. We made it back to the main road and the airport. At 30,000 feet over Germany, I peered out of the plane window, hoping a ball of light might be following us, but sadly not. Igor's story was fascinating but confusing. The mysterious bell, the henge, the wartime sightings of glowing objects. What did they amount to? Could any of it be corroborated? And if anti-gravity is possible, why was I flying Ryanair? I took what I'd learned in Poland to a range of experts.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm just right if you could help me.
First, I contacted Pete Edwards of the University of Durham's physics department and gave him details of what Igor had told me. One of his central claims was that German anti-gravity research had departed from Einstein's approach. Did that make sense?
We can't combine Einstein's picture of gravity with our theory of all the other forces. The theory we have to explain how electricity and magnetism works and two other forces that exist in the universe is through what's called a quantum field theory, right? Now, we can't quantize gravity, so gravity is a pain. So there is that problem, actually, and I agree with Igor. In the transcription, he says, if progress is to be made in gravity research, researchers need to depart from Einstein's description, and that's probably true, actually.
Never mind gravity. I couldn't quantize any evidence to stand the theory up. The SS were pretty good at destroying incriminating paperwork. But maybe there might be clues in the post-war period as to what subsequently happened to any groundbreaking research.
And I have here the initial report that they made.
My next contact had some very interesting paperwork. It related to a craft which did appear almost out of this world.
There's a picture of it. If you look at the back here, it shows the estimated performance. See, these are quite incredible numbers.
Mark Pilkington is the author of Mirage Men and has explored the whole UFO phenomenon. The documents he showed me referred to Project Y, a Canadian, British and American venture of the early 1950s, developed by aircraft designer John Frost. It was the closest encounter so far with a flying saucer that had actually been built.
Time from hovering start to 36,000 feet, 1.7 minutes.
Mach 3.4.
That was the maximum speed, which is
3.5 times the speed of sound.
Yes, 2,300 miles an hour, they thought this thing would go.
And they built this engine, and this all worked?
That's where things get murky. There's a internal Air Force memo that says Project Y2, as it was then called, is now ready for flight testing, and that's the last anyone hears of it.
Murky indeed. But from the point of view of my investigation, I needed to know, was there any German involvement in the design?
It's very likely that John Frost would have spoken to German engineers who would have been looking at vertical takeoff and landing craft for Germany during the end of the war. So there's no question that John Frost would have gone round talking to a lot of these people to find out what they'd worked on.
I wanted to know more about Project Y. For example, what and where? I tracked down someone who'd been through the archives.
Hi.
David Myra worked on the Apollo space program and is now a historian.
Hello, Steve.
He spent years researching Nazi aircraft, and he had bad news.
To make a long story short here, the thrust was not sufficient enough to really lift the entire aircraft acceptably, and it didn't lift up very far. We're talking maybe 30 meters.
Yes. So to your knowledge, the craft that was developed under Project Y never got more than 30 meters off the ground?
Yes.
30 meters? Far from a flying saucer, it was barely a hovering frisbee, a 40-watt ball of light. The 2,300-mile-an-hour top speed, presumably just a handy pitch to the Pentagon for research dollars. The Project Y angle just wasn't going to fly. But David had spent years tracking down and interviewing many German aircraft designers. Did any of them spill the beans on other projects?
I would ask these people, oh, by the way, you know there's a lot of talk about flying saucer research, anti-gravity, levitation, exotic propulsion systems. There was not a single person, not a single individual, who knew anything about such design work. And I'm not just covering it up or anything like that.
And I didn't doubt him, but I had one last witness to speak to. Nick Cook, former aerospace editor of Jane's Defence Weekly and author of The Hunt for Zero Point. He had also visited that hillside in Poland where I'd been some weeks earlier, and I decided to compare notes. I asked him, what did he make of the bell?
It was beguiling but perplexing, because there was certainly surface evidence to show that something very secret had been going on at this mine, and possibly it was the bell. But on the other hand, there was no actual proof, to my mind, that the Bell project was what Igor and other people subsequently have said it was, which was some kind of anti-gravity device.
And what of the henge, that strange concrete ring? According to Igor, a test bed for some exotic craft.
The henge is definitely a kind of intriguing and very imposing structure. And when I first came across it on a sort of dark autumnal evening, lit by the headlights of our car as we approached it, you know, it does create a very strong impression. The problem is that, again, it might look like the test rig for some form of very powerful engine, but it also looks like the base structure of a cooling tower.
A cooling tower for a power station. But what was a power station doing in a remote valley miles from anywhere? And what was down in the converted mine where even the ventilation shafts were protected by armed guards in bunkers? I didn't doubt my Polish contact was onto something, but what? At the end of the war, the mine was sealed. But according to Igor, the bell was spirited away to a safe haven, its secrets intact to this day. And to this day, we can't account for what those bomber crews saw flying alongside them. Those scores of air crew who made official reports of glowing balls of light in the sky.
Keep line abreast and above. Keep line abreast and above. Over to you, Ola.
In the end, as I typed up the report on my own close encounters with the Third Reich, I had to conclude that with the facts so thin on the ground, the truth is still up in the air.
Punt PI was produced by Lawrence Grizel. Tracy was played by Sean Baker.